following story was first published in Visions, 1993. It's being read from the book Haunted Tales of the Grotesque, copyright 1994 by Joyce Carol Oates. Read by Goblin Hood. Phase change. Who is it? Did he follow me in here, or was he waiting just inside the door? Julia Matterling sensed rather than saw the man watching her. She had not yet looked at him, had not confronted him. He stood motionless to her extreme left, against a wall, at the very periphery of her vision. It seemed that he exerted a palpable gravitational tug. Julia was alert rather than alarmed or even apprehensive, for in this public place she was certainly in no danger. In the county clerk's office in the basement of the Broome County Courthouse on a busy weekday afternoon, she had come to get her and her husband's updated passports and was now about to leave, having given a check to the woman behind the counter and having slipped the passports and the receipt into her handbag. Turning with a studied casualness, Julia glanced at the man she believed had been watching her, seeing to her surprise that he was in uniform. He was one of the numerous sheriff's deputies stationed at intervals in the courthouse, and with an unsettling bluntness, he was watching her. Do I know him? Impossible. Does he know me? A swarthy-skinned man in his mid-30s with deep-set, derisive eyes, lank, graying brown hair, an ironic mouth. He had a coarse country boy attractiveness, but had grown thick-bodied, beefy. His gunmetal gray uniform with blue trim fitted him snugly at the torso. Julia could see, or believed she could see, the bulge of his shiny black leather holster and the grip of his revolver above his left thigh. He was a stranger and could not possibly know Julia Matterling or her husband, Norman. Yet, rudely, he continued to stare at her as if they were acquainted. No, stop. I don't know you. Their eyes met and held for several seconds. Then, confused, blushing, Julia looked pointedly away and walked quickly out of the clerk's office. She wondered at the womanly instinct to feel guilt for arousing male interest, as if there could be any reasonable grounds for her complicity. What a dreary place, the Broome County Courthouse. Julia was eager to be gone, but hesitated between taking the stairs back up to the first floor or the elevator. She had taken the stairs down, but the stairway was grimy and dim lit, not very pleasant. She had recently heard that a friend from college, a woman executive at CBS, had been raped and badly beaten in a stairwell in some presumably safe building in New York City. What horror! The elevator was a safer prospect, Julia thought, so she punched the up button and waited. Is he watching? Following me? No. She glanced covertly over her shoulder, but saw only an elderly black woman and a boy entering the county clerk's office. The sheriff's deputy was nowhere in sight. My imagination? Ridiculous. For Julia Matterling was not a young woman. She was 37 years old. Even as a girl in the prime of her small-boned, dark-eyed prettiness, she had not been one to feel eyes drawn irresistibly to her as she entered a room or walked down a street, nor had she wanted such attention. For what, in fact, does such abstract male interest mean? Does it hold a promise or a threat? The elevator was maddeningly slow. Like the courthouse generally, it was old, even antiquated. Julia pressed the up button again and waited, trying to forestall nervousness, how eager she was, like a silly, frightened child, to be gone. The Matterlings, Julia and Norman, lived in the suburban village of Queenston, 20 miles away. Like most Queenston residents, they rarely visited the grimy industrial city that was the county seat. Except on unavoidable official business, Julia had not been here for years. Norman perhaps had never been here. He held the title of Distinguished Research Fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Sciences at Queenston, and when, grudgingly, he agreed to travel at all, it was usually thousands of miles to scientific conferences in distant parts of the globe. So absorbed in his work, so preoccupied, like an overgrown child, even when, during dinner, Norman frowned at his plate, chewing slower and slower. The man was busy, he was working, and Julia had learned not to interrupt. She had a job as an assistant curator at a privately endowed art museum in Queenston, but she attended to all of the household chores and local errands, like getting her and Norman's passports updated. Norman was scheduled to give an important paper on phase changes in the early universe in Tokyo next month. Julia hoped to accompany him. She did not mind being responsible for the practical, domestic side of their lives. She had never minded. She had no children to care for and no dependents except Norman. A contract between the practical and the celestial, between the ordinary and the extraordinary. At last the elevator arrived, the door opened, and Julia automatically stepped inside, seeing, too late, even as the door slid shut behind her, that there was a single other passenger in the car, the sheriff's deputy. Julia stared at him, too surprised at first to be frightened. It was him. But how had he slipped past her to get to another floor of the building? He was smiling at her, baring his uneven yellow teeth in a sniggering grimace. He shook his head, brusque as a dog, flicking a strand of greasy hair out of his eyes. Julia whispered, "What are you? Who are?" Even as he moved toward her, at her, as Julia gave a little scream and pushed at him with her handbag, the deputy took hold of her by both shoulders, shoved her back against the wall of the elevator so that she cried out in pain, pressed himself against her in a lewd, grinding manner. "No, stop! Help!" Julia's words were cut off as her assailant jammed the palm of his hand against her mouth. Seen so closely, the man's skin was roughly textured as if pitted. His eyes were damp, cruel, derisive, as an oily sheen covered his face. Julia could no longer cry aloud. Her protests were silent, interior. Don't hurt me. Who are you? As the elevator rose in drunken lurches, past the first floor, past the second, past the third, and now her assailant, laughing, panting, had pulled the skirt of Julia's beige linen suit up past her hips. Crudely, he'd unzipped his trousers, with no mind for how he was hurting her. Slamming her back against the wall, he thrust his penis at her, between her legs and then into her. Or was he thrusting the barrel of his revolver into her? Julia screamed behind his hand, "No, no, not me!" As a sensation of scalding water splashed over her, centered in her loins, coursing rapidly through her body, and Julia awoke, terrified, panting, desperate to free herself from something twisted between her legs. Dead clothes. Was she in bed? Dazed, she groped beside her to feel a presence in the dark, in the bed. Dark, warm, heavy, inert, her husband asleep. "Thank God! Oh, thank God!" Julia whispered aloud. What an ugly dream. How vivid, lifelike, and what shame to it. But Norman had not been disturbed. He lay on his back, a damp hoarse rattle in his throat, oblivious of Julia's anguish. It must have been about 4 o'clock in the morning. Julia lay shivering in her sweat-soaked nightgown, stiffly on her side of the bed, drifting in and out of a troubled sleep for the remainder of the night. She was grateful for Norman's uninterrupted sleep, which was like that of a great infant. Norman sometimes worked through the night and slept fitfully during the day, but when he slept at night, it was this enviable sleep of oblivion, as if the very particles of his being were in dissolution, like that of the early universe, which was his life's work. He will never know. By the time the room lightened with dawn, Julia had forgotten most of her dream. when examining her face in the bathroom mirror next morning, she noticed a plum-like bruise on her throat. She had no idea what might have caused it. She'd forgotten even the struggle of her dream, her abrupt wrenching into consciousness. Next morning, after Norman left for the center, Julia drove to the Broome County Courthouse as she planned. How odd, how uncanny. As she parked her car, approached the building, began climbing the stairs, she began to feel a curious sensation of apprehension and excitement. How familiar the old courthouse was, outside and in, how familiar its very odor, as if she'd been there only recently, when in fact she had not been there for years. Julia took the elevator to the basement and hurried to the county clerk's office, picked up her and Norman's passports, paid the fee without incident. Yet to her embarrassment, her hands shook visibly as she made out a check. She looked around the room, seeing only strangers, clerks behind the counter, a sheriff's deputy stationed beside the door, no one taking the slightest notice of Julia Matterlin. She knew herself as an attractive woman past the bloom of her youth, but not strikingly attractive. Norman had once believed her beautiful, telling her shyly, clumsily, as if it were a modest truth that might be refuted with uneasy laughter on Julia's part. It had not been. Deeply moved, willing to believe that, in Norman's inexperienced eyes, she was beautiful, Julia had remained silent. This morning, wearing her tailored beige linen suit and tasteful shoes with a modest heel, pearl button earrings in her ears, Julia would surely not have expected, not nor indeed welcomed, any attention from strangers, and it seemed quite fitting that, passing through the Broome County Courthouse on her perfunctory errand, she drew no one's attention at all, as if she were invisible. Like one of Norman's quarks, or is it leptons, hadrons, gluons, squarks, passing invisibly, by magic, through a vacuum? Julia noticed several sheriff's deputies in their smart gray uniforms with blue trim, stationed at intervals around the building. There seemed little need for them at the present time, but Julia supposed that, when a trial was in session, there might be the threat of sudden violence. How bored some of them looked, like museum guards. She wondered idly, a curious thought for her, whether, in their enforced lethargy, they dreamt with their eyes open. When Julia left by the front door of the courthouse, one of the deputies, a swarthy-skinned man with lank gray and brown hair, politely pushed the door open for her, murmuring, "Exit here, ma'am." But even he scarcely glanced at her. Yet, how good Julia Matterlin felt, her morning's errand completed, and her quick return to Queenston, and the solace of her weekday schedule before her. The sensation of dread and excitement was already beginning to lift. What is happening to me? What change is coming over me? And why at this time? The visit to the courthouse was on a Tuesday. 3 days later, slipping into a seat at the rear of a crowded amphitheater at the Center for Advanced Study in Queenston, where a symposium on the structure of the universe was in session, Julia felt again that uncanny sensation, a dread so extreme as to be almost nausea, overlaid with a childlike excitement and yearning. She had hurried to the center from the art museum in which she worked, not wanting to be late for the 4:30 session, or, if late, which was seemingly unavoidable, hoping not to be conspicuous in her lateness. Norman would surely not notice. Norman was not a man to notice such trivial matters. But others, his colleagues and their wives, would see and disapprove. Julia entered the room breathless, sat quickly, tried to collect her thoughts. Why is my heart beating so fast? Am I going to faint? For the 14 years of her marriage to Norman Matterlin, Julia had been attending professional sessions to hear her distinguished husband speak. Surely she had no reason to feel this afternoon a wife's anxiety. On a raised platform at the front of the room, a panel of 5 male scientists, prominent among them Norman Matterlin with his silvery blonde wispy hair and his thick lensed glasses was discussing a problem of some urgency. Julia strained to hear such terms as radius of curvature, supersymmetry, phase change, horizon problem were being uttered. These were teasingly familiar to Julia, had not her husband tried to explain them to her many times. For we are living in a revolutionary epoch, Norman Matterling believed, and it is a pity, if not a tragedy, for anyone to be left behind. Julia saw with pride how everyone in the amphitheater, rows and rows of men and women, leaned forward intently as the panelists debated the significance of recent laboratory experiments in which, astonishingly, the conditions of the early universe, the universe as it was when it was a mere 1/10 billionth of a second old, had been simulated by way of machines that accelerated two beams of protons to nearly the speed of light, then let them collide head-on. In these collisions, temperatures were raised to the probable levels of that point in time when the weak and the electromagnetic forces in the universe unified. Therefore, Norman Matterling said in a quavering voice, it is possible to theorize. Julia winced to see that Norman was wearing the bulky, frayed, hunter-green corduroy jacket she was certain she had thrown out years ago, and that his wispy hair rose from his scalp as if charged with static electricity. Why didn't he wet it down? When Norman was in earnest, as he was now, rising clumsily from his seat to hurry to the blackboard to scrawl a lengthy, illegible equation, he began to stammer. Spittle flew from his lips. He had the look of a bear on its hind legs, gaze turned inward with the effort of keeping its balance. Yet, with what respect the other panelists turned to him, with what hushed interest the entire audience listened, Norman was promulgating a theory about an early phase change of the universe, which occurred at a time so immediately after the Big Bang as to defy comprehension by any means other than mathematical. 10^35 seconds, which was represented by a decimal point, 34 zeros, and then a 1. Prior to this, apparently, quarks had frozen into hadrons. Julia smiled uneasily. Had she known that? A phase change was a change from one state to another, as when gas changes to liquid, liquid to solid, solid to gas, the seemingly whole into the infinitely fragmented. A phase change was not deducible, but only to be experienced. A phase change was not irrevocable. Norman Matterling was speaking of supersymmetrical particles forming a mirror image of the observed world. From this, one could deduce an entire shadow universe, a mirror of the universe we inhabit. Interacting with ours, Norman said excitedly, only through the force of gravity. So, at this, another panelist, an astrophysicist from Caltech, rudely interrupted and strode to the blackboard to scribble an unintelligible equation of his own. Julia was deeply absorbed in the exchange, even as, heart pounding as if she were approaching a crisis of which she had no conscious awareness, she slipped quietly out of her seat, needing to find a lavatory. How many times had she attended meetings and social gatherings at the center, yet, to her frustration, she invariably had difficulty locating a woman's room. Perhaps, in this monastic place, so primarily male, there were in fact few facilities for women, and the maze of corridors, flights of stairs, glass cul-de-sacs overlooking empty Japanese gardens. What did it remind her of but the phenomenon of the rapidly expanding universe? Faintness means farness and madness. But Julia was not thinking of such things. Gripping her handbag so tightly her knuckles turned white, she was thinking only of the weakness in her bowels. And then, what relief. She found a woman's lavatory just around a corner from the center's kitchen facilities. She used a toilet, then stood at a sink, splashing cold water onto her face. At an adjacent sink stood a plump, plain-faced woman with gray hair wrapped in braids around her head washing her hands vigorously. Julia said with forced vivacity, wiping her face, "I wish I could understand them, don't you? I know they hold the secrets of the universe, the real universe, not ours. Actually, I got A's in high school physics and calculus. I'm not an ignorant person, but I can't remember anything I've learned, and it's getting worse. Dozens of times I've been told what a quark is, what a black hole is, what omega means, but I never remember. I never know. Sometimes I just wish it would all go away, just vanish." Julia laughed, expecting the woman to join in. But the woman merely stared at her coldly, wiped her hands on a towel, and left the room. Julia realized belatedly, to her extreme embarrassment, that the woman was none other than Elsa Heisenberg, a relative of the great Werner Heisenberg, and a renowned astronomer at Palomar Observatory. Julia caught her own blurry gaze in the mirror above the sink. "Aren't you a fool, mistaking her for you?" She did not want to miss any more of the symposium, but in her haste to return to the amphitheater, apparently she took a wrong turn and lost her way. She found herself wandering in an airless, overheated corridor, turned a corner, and found herself at the rear of the center's kitchen area, where several workers, husky young black men in white uniforms, were lounging around a table smoking cigarettes. "Marijuana? Hashish?" Julia's nostrils pinched at the sweet, acrid, piercing odor. As soon as the black men saw Julia, their eyes opened wide and their postures stiffened perceptibly. Shyly, Julia said, "Excuse me, but I seem to be lost. How do I get back to the amphitheater?" The men continued to stare at her as if they had never seen anyone quite like her. They were now standing as if at attention, the youngest a lanky brown-skinned youth with a bizarre flat-top haircut and woolly hair shaved and sculpted around the base of his head, giggled shrilly and hid his cigarette behind his back. Another squat and thick neck with a broad, brutal, purplish-black skin face and lips that looked swollen, grinned at Julia suggestively. "Do they know me? Do I know them? Were they waiting for me at this juncture of time and space and contingency?" There were four black men in dazzling white waiters' uniforms, white teeth, white smiles, gold fillings glittering amid those smiles, several gold earrings in the left ear of one, in the left ear of the youngest. If these constituted a code, what did the code mean? Julia saw that the men were exchanging glances, easing slyly forward. One, surely no less than 6 feet, 7 inches tall, with a glaring ebony black skin, had sidestepped adroitly to the right, blocking Julia's path should she try to flee. Julia gripped her handbag tight in both hands. She stood tall and with as much authority as she could summon, very frightened, faintness washing over her, but she tried to speak calmly, reasonably. I seem to have taken a wrong turn. Can you help me, please? Which way is..." She pondered, wondering if these uncouth men would know what the word amphitheater meant. "The foyer? The front of the building?" The men's eyes widened yet further and glittered with mirth. Their lips twitched. "I'm attending a symposium on the structure of the universe. In fact, my husband is one of the participants, so I don't want to miss a word. The secrets of the universe are being revealed. Mankind's conception of the heavens is being revolutionized totally, so if you could help me, please..." Julia was backing away even as the black men were advancing upon her, springy and lithe on their feet as great supple black predator cats. Suddenly, too panicked, Julia turned to run, turned her ankle and nearly fell. Her handbag went flying. The youngest black man caught her, his fingers strong as steel, long enough to encircle her ribcage. "No, please, let me go. Oh, please," she begged. "I've never been a prejudiced woman, I swear. I know that Queenston is a white enclave, but I don't share in the prejudices of my neighbors. I am the wife of..." The young black man squealed with laughter, shoving Julia roughly at one of his friends, who caught her by the upper arm and shut his fist in her hair and gave her head a cruel shake. Julia drew breath to scream, but could not. She was groveling, panting, whispering, "I am the wife of..." But her mind had gone blank. She could not remember her husband's name, nor even her own. I am not here then, am I? Or if here, who? Julia Matterling struggled courageously with her assailants, even as, cruelly outnumbered and overpowered as she was, so petite and terrified a woman, she must have known it was hopeless to resist. She could not scream except inwardly, silently, "No, no, please, don't you know who I am?" Disgusting, rude lips mashed against hers. A slap to the side of her head made her ears ring. Her breasts were being fondled, squeezed, pinched. Her buttocks were being kneaded like doughy white bread. "No, please, not me, not here." The men towered over her, laughing shrilly, exuding a smell of primal male sweat. Horrible. Julia was being shoved this way and that, passed from one man to another as if this were a game, and she a living basketball or football. No matter how she wept, thrashed from side to side, pleaded, "No, don't, have mercy." But the black men in their dazzling white waiters' uniforms had no mercy for Julia Matterling. In the very building in which her distinguished husband was speaking on the subject of the structure of the universe, its probable origin and its probable end, Julia Matterling was being dragged into the steamy interior of a kitchen, her wrists gripped tight as if by steel manacles, the nape of her neck gripped too. She was flung like a carcass over a table as, with prudent dexterity, black hands quickly shoved aside trays of fruit cups and dinner salads. For a banquet for the 200 participants of the symposium was shortly to begin. Now nearly hysterical, crying, "Help, no, please," as the skirt of her navy blue serge suit was yanked up, her panties dragged down, fingers poked her private parts, as on all sides the black men giggled and grunted and cried in piping high-pitched voices, "Uh-oh," and "Mmm, white meat cunt," and "Eeeeee, man," and Julia blinked dazed at the floor, seeing blood dripping from her nose onto the linoleum tile. And had one of her teeth come loose? "No, no, have mercy, oh please." But there was no mercy for Julia Matterling, their hands on her now naked, squirming body, pinning her fast to the table, one of them straddling her, hot and harsh and pitiless as a jackhammer. What excruciating pain. His gigantic, blood-swollen black penis pushing its way between the cheeks of her unprotected buttocks, into her anus, into the tender interior of the woman's being where no man, certainly not that husband whose name she had forgotten, had ever penetrated. Now Julia Matterling did draw breath to scream, and screamed, and screamed, and woke another time in her bed, in the dark, amid tangled, sweat-smelling bedclothes. "I'm not here then, am I? Or if here, who?" How shameful, unspeakable. Julia was revulsed by the dream, so vivid. Had it been a dream? And did her best to forget. Yet the following day and the following, even as details rapidly faded, the horror stayed with her as if somehow it continued to exist in some other dimension of the universe. Of course, Julia was determined to hide her agitation from Norman, who would have been confused and upset if he knew. Can one inhabit madness and yet not be mad? Julia wondered if madness might pass through a human being, like those subatomic particles whose names she could never quite recall. Neurons? Neutrinos? Passing through solid matter, bearing chaos, yet causing not so much as a ripple on the surface of the observed world. He will never know, will he? Julia could not remember the details nor the very outline of her dream, except to know that it had taken place at the center of all unlikely settings for a nightmare. But she understood guiltily, with a sense of womanly shame, that another time she had had a lethal effect upon a man or men. Touching her, a man or men vanished. She smiled. No, she was not smiling. She was concerned, disturbed. Am I a fatal woman, then, without my knowing? She knew it was all absurd, sheer fantasy. Yet days passed and nights, and she dreaded sleep, dreaded its power over her. Norman noticed nothing, fortunately. Julia was fiercely protective of him, the way a mother might be with a gifted child, obscurely handicapped, disabled. He will never know, must never. When Julia kissed him in greeting, or as he was about to leave the house, he frequently smiled at her, startled and pleased, and hugged her, indeed, like a child. "Dear Julia, I love you," he would murmur. Julia was equally determined to keep whatever the horror was of which she must not think separate from her work at the Queenston Art Museum, for she was a professional woman after all, wasn't she? Yet it happened, to Julia's dismay, that she began to feel, even in the museum, that sense of anticipation and dread she'd felt elsewhere, even in the sanctuary of her office. What is happening to me? What is this change coming upon me? Suddenly, one morning, a few days after the symposium on the structure of the universe, hosted by the Center for Advanced Study at Queenston, for indeed there had been a symposium, Julia realized at her desk that her pulse was unnaturally fast and that she was startled by the most innocuous of things. Her ringing telephone, the sound of voices in the corridor, the museum curator summoning her into his office. The curator, a man of self-consciously vigorous middle age, was subtly yet unmistakably gay, with absolutely no erotic interest in Julia Matterling or in any other woman. Passing by the museum guards, as she'd done countless times, Julia felt strangely dizzy, did not dare glance up at them, still less smile and greet them by name as she normally did. "No, don't look. It's better not to know." The thought haunted her since that last incompletely recalled nightmare. The kitchen of the center? But why the kitchen? And had there been more than one assailant? That, without her wish, she had the curious power to destroy. For when men advanced upon her, when actually they dared touch her, they were punished severely by imploding, vanishing, which was what they deserved, animals. Yes, but Julia did not want that sort of thing, that violence, to occur. Certainly she did not want it to occur. She was not a vindictive woman. She was not a hysterical woman. That morning, the curator had arranged for Julia to meet with a Hawaiian-born sculptor whose work the museum was considering for an exhibit. As Julia nervously examined slides of the man's sculptures through a viewer and asked questions of him meant to be friendly, polite, she became acutely aware of him staring at her, frowning at her, sitting at the edge of his chair, head thrust forward in a way that could only be belligerent. Or was the man shy, awkward, socially disadvantaged? Julia blinked at the massive, ugly, teasingly obscene hulks of scrap metal that constituted the sculptor's art, and had no idea what to think or to say. Her mind was going blank, evaporating. Waves of panic stirred in her belly. She moved her arm, and the sculptor moved his, as in a mirror. Mocking? His features were oriental, yet Caucasian, his skin dark as if tanned, his eyes hooded. "Who are you? Do I know you? Do you know me?" Julia had asked the sculptor about his background, and he had answered gruffly in monosyllables, then fell silent, staring at her. On Julia's desk was a brass lamp, small but heavy, covertly. Her fear increasing, she measured the distance between the lamp and her right hand. "If you dare, threaten me." Now her pulse was racing erratically, and she understood that the sculptor was well aware of her distress. When she wiped moisture from her upper lip in a gesture intended to be unobtrusive, the sculptor mirrored it mockingly by sighing and wiping his forehead on the sleeve of his denim jacket. Then their eyes met. "No, not again. Never again." As the sculptor was about to lunge forward, as Julia sensed he was about to lunge forward, she stood suddenly, snatched up the lamp to defend herself, and stammered, "Thank you. You can leave now. You've said enough. Please take your slides." The sculptor gaped at her. All mockery and masculine arrogance drained from his face, the very swarthiness of his skin turning pale. "Just leave, now, quickly, before there's danger," Julia cried. And so, quickly sweeping his slides into a duffel bag, the sculptor did. Julia looked around her. at the walls, the windows, the familiar dimensions of the room. Nothing had changed. All was as it had been. She remained where she was, exactly where she was, trembling behind her desk, the heavy brass lamp pressed against her breasts. I'm not here then, am I? Or if here, who? She was sobbing. She had lost all shame, opening her heart to one who would help. Doctor, I'm so frightened of losing my mind. I believe I'm approaching a nervous breakdown, madness. Dr. Fitzjames smiled sympathetically yet doubtfully. Approaching, Julia? Julia stared at him, blinking. Was it a poor word choice? One approached a point in time or in space. One approached, for instance, an abyss. But could one approach anything so intangible as a nervous breakdown? She said, stammering, Doctor, I have such dreams, such ugly, hateful, obscene dreams. And now they're spilling over into real life. That's what I fear most. She paused, pressing a tissue against her eyes, conscious of Dr. Fitzjames' thoughtful look. He was a much admired Queenston doctor, not a psychiatrist nor a psychoanalyst, but an internist with a reputation for being kindly, informative, up-to-date, intuitively shrewd, with a particular gift for understanding women. Quite coincidentally, Dr. Fitzjames resembled Norman Matterling in build and physical appearance, though not manner. Where Norman was abstract and dreamy, Dr. Fitzjames was alert, almost unsettlingly watchful. Julia felt that he anticipated her very words as she spoke. And the dreams aren't my own, really. They seem to be the dreams of another person, a mad woman. Indeed, Julia, but how do you know? How do I know? Patiently, bringing the tips of his blunt, stubby fingers together, Dr. Fitzjames said, When human beings dream, they are not conscious. Thus, they cannot know anything with certainty, nor even that they are not conscious. Not even that they are not conscious. He smiled, as if addressing a young child or a very slow-witted person. It's a familiar conundrum. How do we know we are awake when we are awake? Where is the evidence? The material world seems to us real. He struck the top of his desk smartly with his knuckles so that Julia, whose nerves were strung tight as a bow, started. And so, no doubt, it is. But are we in it, as we think we are? And who are we? He paused for dramatic effect. Julia was beginning to feel quite helpless. And when we wake, Julia, and consciousness floods back, the dreaming self vanishes, irretrievable. So, how can we have knowledge of that other self, of the dreams it engenders? How like Norman Matterling the man was, the wisps of graying hair, the broad, somewhat heavy face, the pale blue eyes behind polished lenses, the sense he communicated of absolute and unwavering logic, irrefutable. But Dr. Fitzjames was several years younger than Norman Matterling, his big body more muscular than fatty. There was a masculine edge to his voice that comforted Julia, yet also disturbed her. For possessed of logic as the internist was he also possessed of truth? Julia wiped at her eyes and said weakly, yet stubbornly, Whatever it is, Doctor, whether I know or not, I'm terribly upset. I dread falling asleep. I've had a kind of flu and have been running a temperature. I had a misunderstanding at the museum where I work and have taken sick leave for a while. It's all I can do to get through the day, running our household without Norman suspecting that anything is wrong. He'd be devastated if he knew. He depends upon me so completely. Now this fact was uttered, Julia understood it was a fact, perhaps a central fact of her existence as a wife. Dr. Fitzjames nodded in apparent agreement. Julia said, shuddering, And what I think I can remember of my dreams, so ugly, repulsive, hideous. Julia wept, laughed, hid her face. But Dr. Fitzjames said in the same sympathetic yet skeptical voice, rising from his desk to lead Julia into an examination room. Now, Julia, you women should remember that certain facts are no more than passing moods, a jangle of neurons, sheer ephemera. Your dreams, my dear, and the disgust they engender are not real, thus not important. Julia entered the examination room, which was brightly lit. With a clinical chill, Since childhood, she had dreaded physical examinations, even as she understood their necessity. If I am good, if I obey, will I be helped, loved? She whispered. Not important. Dr. Fitzjames laughed. Not set beside physical facts. To this, Julia could make no objection. She began to undress with trembling fingers, removing her outer garments, then shivering her brassiere and panties. Grateful that Dr. Fitzjames was averting his eyes. On the examination table lay an oversized paper smock into which Julia quickly slipped. If I am good, if I obey. As she had told the doctors, she was slightly feverish, had not slept more than a few hours in the past several nights, nor had she any appetite. How she hoped Dr. Fitzjames might find a physical disorder underlying her malaise, for which she might take pills, the most efficient of solutions. Julia lay on the examination table, her bare feet in the stirrups and her thighs widespread. Dr. Fitzjames murmured, "Move up just a bit, Julia," and she felt the warmth of his breath against her skin. "If I am good, 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 if I obey." There was no disguising the fact that Julia was shivering with anticipation, excitement, or dread. Her entire pubic region was exposed to the chill, unsparingly bright air of the examination room and to Dr. Fitzjames's professional scrutiny. Why was there no nurse in attendance? But Julia was grateful there was none. Her eyelids fluttered. The overhead lights in the ceiling beyond shimmered, as if on the brink of dissolution. Dr. Fitzjames murmured in a muffled, choked-sounding voice, "Now, my dear, this may tickle a little, just a routine check for growths." With finger-gloved hands, he began to press, squeeze, massage Julia's pelvic region, her lower abdomen, her stomach, her breasts. Julia drew in her breath sharply and held it. "Oh, oh," she might have laughed shrilly or cried, "Oh, doctor." So thorough was the internist, he did the entire procedure a second time, yet more forcibly. "Oh, doctor," Julia cried, biting her lower lip. "Very fine, very fine," Dr. Fitzjames said. He was perspiring. His balloon face looming above Julia had an oily sheen. "Now, do relax. We'll look at your uterus and do a pap smear." Julia made an effort to relax even as she anticipated discomfort, pain. She saw, to her horror, a tray of glittering instruments on a table close by, several scalpels, one of them the length of a steak knife, a device that uncannily resembled an ice cream scoop, another that resembled an egg beater, still another with an expandable head to dilate the vagina. "Obey, if I obey, will I be loved, saved?" She had stiffened, gripping the sides of the examination table tight. Her knees, with no support, were badly trembling. Julia's instinct was to bring them together, even as, gently yet firmly, Dr. Fitzjames spread them apart. "Now, my dear, this may hurt a little, just a little," he said, selecting from the tray of instruments the ice cream scoop and disappearing from Julia's view behind her outspread knees. Julia held her breath. She felt a finger probe around the lips of her vagina. No pain, really, yet she stiffened at once. Dr. Fitzjames chided her in a muffled voice. "Dear, do relax. It will be so much better for you if you do." She could hear him breathing, which reminded her of Norman when his sinuses were congested. She made an effort to obey. "Don't touch. Don't dare. Who am I here?" There was a pause, then the touch of cold metal, then, even as Julia drew breath to scream yet could not scream, a sudden piercing pain in her vagina in the birth canal of an intensity she had never before felt in her life. "No, no," Julia tried to slide away from Dr. Fitzjames, but with his left hand he was gripping her buttocks so tightly she could not move. Even as Julia struggled, the cruel instrument plunged deeper. A nova of pain filled her body, and scarcely knowing what she did, Julia reached out for something with which to defend herself, and there was the knife-sized scalpel suddenly in her fingers, so deftly, so lethally fitted to her fingers. She was screaming, "Now, now! This is happening now!" as, in a frenzy, she slashed and stabbed at the astonished man whose name she no longer knew, bright blood at once splashing the white outfit, blood on his face, blood on his flailing hands, blood pouring from a severed artery in his throat. "I warned you, and now, now!" her assailant stumbling backward with that look of rapt and utter astonishment on his face, colliding with the table, bearing the tray of gleaming instruments, and vanished. And Julia Mattering awoke another time, dazed and terrified, to find herself where? In her bed. In her bedroom of many years, amid tangled bedclothes that gave off a reek of panic. Pain throbbed in her loins, and the nipples of both breasts were raw. How had it happened? Night, she was alone, switching on her bedside lamp with badly shaking fingers. Were they bloodstained? No. Julia saw it was 3:20 a.m. Norman was awake, elsewhere in the house, working. "I'm not here, then, am I? Or if here, who?" It was the night following the day of the embarrassment at the art museum, the misunderstanding involving the Hawaiian-born sculptor who had or had not made threatening gestures toward Julia Mattering. All had agreed a sick leave might be advised. Shakily, Julia rose from bed. Was it bloodstained? No. Ran a bath in the adjoining bathroom, water as steamingly hot, as cleansing as she could bear. She could not recall the ugly dream that had wakened her, but she seemed to know that her assailant had been someone she knew, clad in white. He had hurt her badly, and then he'd been destroyed, banished, like the others. Stiff with pain, but she smiled. Gone where? Startled then, she glanced up at the door, up as the door was pushed open, and there stood Norman, perplexed, disapproving, his hair standing up in wispy tufts. "Julia, what are you doing at this hour of the morning?" Surely he had every right to be annoyed. Norman Mattering, fresh from the isolation of his work amid galaxies, stars, atoms, quarks, leptons, primal cosmic soup, ready at last for bed. And where was his wife? How strangely he was staring at her, Julia in her nakedness, a sight he rarely saw, her shimmering pale body, her delicate frame, breasts gleaming damp, the shadowy pubic hair at the base of her belly, scarcely visible. And how strangely, too, Julia smiled up at him, a taunting, provocative, sexual smile, lifting her arms to him, yes, and her knees raised, too. Julia heard herself say, in a low, suggestive voice, "What do you think I'm doing, Norman?"